Me in prayer, we'll begin our study. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to be able to connect with you in spiritual things. Help us as Bible students to be good readers, good listeners, and to use discernment in our understanding of the message. Help our faith to grow. When we are challenged, help us to understand the source of the adversity. If it comes from you, help us accept it with patience. If it comes from the world, allow us to build faith through endurance. No matter what the challenge is ahead of us, help us to understand that we are built for a return to heaven and to recognize our place in the kingdom. This is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so as noted, we are continuing in our series of looks at the Gospel of Luke. And what I would like for us to do right now is to pay attention to chapter 4 and verses 14 and following as we kind of get a handle or an understanding on parts, at least, of what Jesus's big picture is. In the Gospel of Luke, we don't get that deep record of the Sermon on the Mount that the Gospel of Matthew gives to us. And we sometimes will use that sermon as the encapsulation of what we think Jesus is focusing on. What's interesting is the Gospel of Luke does give us some of his sermons. You get the Sermon on the Plain in the Gospel of Luke. You get some of the same ideas and principles, but we don't get the same breakdown. Instead, we're given a whole different perspective. And I think it's important for us to then realize the Sermon on the Mount is, in many ways, the heart of Jesus' work, but it's not all of it. It is a portion of what Jesus taught. It is important. It is a reflection of the work of Jesus as kind of bouncing off the promises of the prophets, but it doesn't necessarily reveal every mystery. It doesn't open up every question we have and provide solutions, because Jesus does something very regularly in the way in which he teaches and instructs. What he will do is he will provide a message that requires us to pause, think, and I used the words earlier, discern. It's equivalent to the idea of interpret or understand. Please keep in mind that when we say interpret, we're not talking about working in the spiritual realm in a prophetic sense. We're talking about it in a sense, what did he mean? When he said this, what is the intended meaning I'm supposed to understand? That happens with parables a lot, where Jesus will make a parable instructional moment. He'll tell us something that's really super obvious, and well, here's an illustration of it. If you're going to build a tower, you should make sure you could finish the project, right? That's a super obvious parable, right? That's actually one of the ones he uses to teach. But is he actually talking about building towers when he says that? No, he's not. In most of the parables, he's not actually talking about the thing that he's talking about. He requires us to discern, interpret, understand, and realize, hey, I'm talking about the kingdom. I'm talking about your moral development. I'm talking about the people who are around us. I'm talking about you. Like, that's what he requires for us to do. So he's no longer speaking in literal terms. He's using these language components to instruct us a little bit more. So when we get this section here in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 4, pay attention to it in that regard as well, because what you're going to see in it is more than just here's some literal facts and figures, here's a map. What you're going to get is, in some ways, a big picture look at Jesus's broad interaction. And he's saying, in essence, to kind of sum part of this up, his mission, his work, his primary goal is one of deliverance, of setting free the captives, of rescue. And we look at that in a couple of different ways. Is it fair to say that the work of Jesus can be simplified down to the salvation of man? Yeah, I think that's one way. But when we say that, what do we mean by that? What does it mean then to be saved? If someone said, hey, are you saved? What do they want from you as an answer, or what do they mean by that question? So they want to maybe know, hey, do you believe in Jesus? Some people mean that when they ask, are you saved? What else might they mean?
You want to know if we have a hope of a home in heaven?
A hope of heaven, Bobby?
Have you obeyed the gospel?
They may be, hey, have you responded to what Jesus said? Being saved implies you were lost beforehand. You ever like cooking a recipe or something and you're missing an ingredient and someone says, hey, I got some. And you're like, you saved me, because the recipe would have been lost for lack of eggs, butter, baking soda, or whatever. Like, you saved it. You made it possible for it to be there, be completed. Salvation is rescue. Salvation is obedience to the gospel. Romans 1:16, Romans 10:10 through 17. Salvation is also restoration. It's a reclamation. You're reclaiming a relationship that you lost. All of those are in the sense of deliverance. Is salvation being set free as a captive? Yeah. You're being let out of prison. He came to make proclamation to set the captives free. So we take these things, we scrunch them down at times, but we remember, hey, it's a lot bigger too. So here in this section of the text, 14 through about verse 30 or so, Jesus has gone from our wilderness picture. Remember, biblical wilderness, not the forests of Georgia. He's not surrounded by pine trees. He's essentially in deserts and like runoff gullies that have water and plants in them. That's the wadis look like that. They look like a big gully cut into the ground, plants and water. And so that's where he had been until he was brought back into Jerusalem. But now he is in Nazareth, and his mission will focus predominantly on a deliverance of all who are willing. We don't know all the details yet. But Nazareth isn't really ready for this. What's Nazareth to Jesus? It's home. You ever feel uncomfortable going back home? Like you don't fit?
If you haven't been there a long time, sometimes you do.
Yeah, sometimes it's uncomfortable. It's because you haven't been there. Like, for me, if I go back to my elementary school, it's really small. Like, I don't remember it being that small. I remember it being huge. And like the fields in the back, those were monstrous, and we could have multiple soccer games. I get back there, I'm like, you could have like maybe two games back here before you're tripping on each other. And the playground space, like I can step from thing to thing where before I felt like I was running. The size has changed, but it hasn't. I've changed. We see things a lot, and we think about Jesus in this regard. Has Jesus actually changed when he goes back to Nazareth at this point? In some senses, the answer is a concrete no. But in other senses, something has changed, right? What's changed about Jesus?
His relationship
with all mankind is starting to change. He has accepted a baptism, though it was not needed in the sense of John's proclamation. It is necessary for it to take place. He's made a declaration about who he is. He's revealed this much of who he is, perhaps. We'll think about it in this tiny little bit. When really there's like way more that he hasn't revealed yet, but just a little bit. And now everyone sees him differently. Kind of. What you're saying, we know who you are. There's no way you could be this. Because just a few years ago, we were working side by side. There was no hint of this in you. We do that all the time, right? When you see somebody doing something that you never thought they would do, it's kind of surprising. Like, I didn't think that person would be interested in that or want to do that, or that would be their thing, and they're doing that thing. Whatever it is. The scale is much larger here. And Jesus has not always had necessarily a normal experience in Nazareth. Was his birth extraordinary? Yeah, it was super extraordinary. And his childhood, extraordinary. But not everyone knows it. We know it. We're super familiar with each of these general details. We feel like we're there with the family as they flee. We feel like we're there with the family as they welcome Jesus, because we're told these things. So we see Jesus as who he will become, even as much as we see as who he is. Now, we look at this. Wait a minute. So back in the text. And Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and a report about him went out all through the surrounding country. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, as was his custom. He went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and he stood up to read. And the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him, and he unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, and recovering the sight of the blind, to set at liberty those who were oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant, and he sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him, and he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." And all spoke well of him and marveled at the gracious words that were coming from his mouth. And they said, "Is not this Joseph's son?" And he said to them, "Doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, 'Physician, heal yourself. What we have heard you did at Capernaum, do here in your hometown as well.'" And he said, "Truly I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his hometown. But in truth, I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut up 3 years and 6 months, and the great famine came over the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elijah, and none of them were cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian." When they heard these things, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath. And they rose up and drove him out of the town and brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so they could throw him down the cliff. But passing through their midst, he went away. There's a weird dynamic there. They are super excited for him until what? They all spoke gladly of him. But what does he say he's not going to do?
Not going to do miracles, just please
him. Yeah, he's not there. He's not going to just put on a show. And he cites the history they're all familiar with, but it's hard to swallow, right? But you're one of us. You're from here. Why won't you do those miracles here? And he cites a realistic fact. I know that I'm not going to be welcome here. That's the interesting turn of the text. We assume that's the case. Jesus demonstrates this attitude of their heart before everything is spelled out for us and the way the text is laid out. Like, he knows how they're going to behave. Is it rational then that they want to throw him off a cliff? Does that make sense? Not whether or not you agree with it. There's a couple of things I think about. Number one, they're upset because he has just condemned them. He has condemned their attitude because what they wanted, he wasn't going to give them. Their response demonstrates the blackness or bleakness of their hearts, because they just want to kill him. Had he not said a thing, had he not shown up that day, They would have gone about their circumstances. But he shows up, as was his habit, reads, they praise him. Oh, that's great. This is going to be awesome. And they make a very earthly human decision. You're not going to give us what you want. We're done with you. That's literally as short as you can get. They're so done with him, they're ready to kill him. Jesus manifests a miracle in their midst. Just not the one they want. What's the miracle he does?
Disappears.
However it is that Luke doesn't describe for us that he passes through their midst. I don't know how he does that. Scripture doesn't say in this context. My presumption is, based on other biblical texts, that this is him being who he is. He is being God. He passes through their midst. It seems to be implied that he does so because of his spiritual nature. And there he is. What's interesting about many of the events here in this early parts of Jesus' life from a faith-building standpoint is many of these locations are well-known and still able to be accessed presently, like right now. We can, if we wanted to, go and see some of them and be present for them. Like, go check them out. Oh, that timer's not what I want. Although perhaps there are times when you might wish that I had a timer on me. I don't know. I'm trying to get to this other one. Let me see if I can get there. All right, well, it's being a rebel today, and so I'm going to fight with it. And take it back over. No, it's not. All right, you. I win. It's all about taking ownership of the right device. That's all it is. All right, so these are a couple of key archaeological sites that connect us back to the time and setting of the work of Jesus as the Messiah. And they're surrounding this. So what we have here is the one that's built on the very foundation of the synagogue at Capernaum, which is, again, a site we're going to see a lot in the Gospel of Luke, but it kind of ties us together with what's going on. It is the foundation, as you can kind of see the black line. See the black line on the left? You can look over here and see this. It then is the same space, the same physicality. The same place where he, as a habit, would go and read from the scriptures. When he leaves Nazareth, this is where he then centralizes his Galilean work. It centers here. What's powerful for us is two other factors. This is going to also then be a center point for the work of Philip, the work of Peter, the work of Paul centers around this region as well. When he starts... Saul at that point, but then we see him later as Paul. It's all in this region on the north side of Jerusalem. So you're looking at a spot, one of the rare places that we can really easily identify and say, this is where the disciples walked. This is where they spoke. This is where they themselves would have engaged in the same kind of habit that Jesus had and that Paul had. If you're looking for a little intertextual note, Jesus' habit, go on the Sabbath, the reason from the scriptures. Paul's habit was to do what? Go find place where people are gathering on the Sabbath and go interact with them. If there's no synagogue, he goes to his plan B. Find a place where people are going to pray. Paul's plan C was to find people who are discussing spiritual things. And so he goes to the markets, the market of ideas. That's what his practice and habit was. So that gives us a good kind of like look into this. And then the text is going to continue, and he's going to continue to read. When they heard these things, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath, and they rose up and drove him out of town and brought him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built, so they could throw him down off a cliff. But passing through their midst, he went on his way. He moved through. And that sets us for the next text, which is an interesting, here's a miracle, moment after they wanted one. He went down to Capernaum, synagogue right here, a city of Galilee, and he was teaching them on the Sabbath. And they were astonished at his teaching, for his word possessed authority. In the synagogue there was a man who had the spirit of an unclean demon, and he cried out with a loud voice, "Ha! What have you done with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And when the demon had come out, thrown him down in their midst, he came out of him, and having done him no harm, and they were all amazed and said to one another, "Who is, or what is this word? For with authority and power he commands the unclean spirits. They come out." And reports about him went out into every place in the surrounding area. And he arose and left the synagogue and entered Simon's house. Now Simon's mother-in-law was ill with a high fever, and they appealed to him on her behalf. And he stood over her and rebuked her fever, and it left her, and immediately she rose and began to serve them. And when the sun was setting, all those who had any who were sick with various diseases brought them to him, and he laid his hands on every one of them and healed them. And demons also came out of many, crying, "You are the Son of God." But he rebuked them and would not allow them to speak, because they knew that he was the Christ. So you have, again, 2 days, about a week apart, by the way they're laid out in the text. Goes to Nazareth, goes to the synagogue, and is rejected. Goes to Capernaum, goes to the synagogue, he's accepted. What's different about these two encounters?
Well, in Nazareth, they knew him as a child, and then saw him as he grew.
So yeah, there's...
He was new.
Nazareth, for sure, that's his home area. We don't know how well he's known in Capernaum. They're relatively close. There could be some level of interaction there. Certainly potential for family connections, but most definitely, yes, on the family level, youth, adults. What do they say about his teaching that's different here?
With authority, power.
Yeah, so on our Nazareth level, it says, "That's wonderful. What you said is great. I really like it." Over here in Capernaum, "This guy's speaking with authority. That's weird. I'm marveling at it. It's strange. It's uncommon." They say two different things. One is simple praise, perhaps based on what they would get. The other one is amazement by the method and the approach of his teaching. Is that the first time that this has been said about him that you're familiar with? Or have you read this elsewhere? It's a repeat, right? It's a repeat from his youth that Luke really doesn't go into detail here, but we remember it. And it's in part of the annoyance / loathing that develops between he and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Because they didn't necessarily teach this way. And most certainly, they didn't like Jesus teaching with any kind of level of authority independent of theirs. That takes place. Also, the very thing that Nazareth wants, he's just letting it all out. All right, let's see. Anyone who has a demon, anyone who's sick, you got a fever, let's go. It's not really, that's the outcome. It's just a huge outpouring of God's power. Recognize that the city here, the space of this area, this small fishing village, is not massive. History suggests that the synagogue is about 200 yards maximum from the supposed location of Peter's mother-in-law's house. Like, and so you can stand at what is the... You can see in this picture here, if you were to stand where the photo was taken and literally just turn 180 degrees around, you can see the foundation of what they think would have been her home based on archaeology and history. Realize whenever we say that about history in the land of Israel, it's approximate. Because they're basing it off of good research and good history, but it's very approximate. Very few locations where they can say, absolutely, this is the spot. Synagogue, absolutely, that's the spot. Her house, probably. Because the city never got much bigger than what it did. And so it's within that boundary. It's within that area. So that means all of this is going on in a very compressed space. You're talking about an area that surrounds... think about it this way. You're looking at a space that's no bigger than twice the downtown block space of Noonan, the courthouse square. Double that out. That's that entire city space. Is those like, if you block that out from the synagogue to the other end of those homes. Like, it's not big. This is a small fishing village. It's right on the coastline as well. The dock space is there. And you can kind of see all of that together in your mind is where Jesus is now laying out his work. And he's fulfilling the thing that he said he was going to do. What he said a week before is beginning to take place. Let's talk about this interaction with the other or unseen realm that he has with this demon. Is that strange based on your reading of the Old Testament? Old Testament doesn't tell us a whole lot about what goes on in the unseen realm, and sometimes things talk in weird ways. Sometimes inanimate stuff talks. Sometimes creatures that don't normally talk start talking. And whenever that happens, it's super important. Like when all those instances where the standard expectation doesn't happen, it's a big deal. Here, nobody is surprised in the text by the presence of demons or that they interact with Jesus. If somebody came into the assembly right now and started behaving exactly like you read a demon-possessed person in the New Testament text behave, what would we do? We might say, that person needs some help. Like, we need to help that person. Maybe they've been injured, and physically their brain has been damaged, and so, like, we got to get them to hospital. Maybe there's some medical conditions that are changed. Maybe they've taken some medication, way too much of it. Maybe they're on illicit drugs. Our immediate things are very carnal and natural, right? This is a problem we got to fix. All of the New Testament interactions of Jesus and demons, he fixes. But people around him don't act like it's a surprise that those people are there. Like, they're not baffled at all by the presence of them. They get confused at times of the dialogue. And I'll tell you, when you read through it, sometimes you're like, I got to stop and think for a minute. What did this guy just say? What did the demon just declare? What we learn here is that man doesn't recognize whom Jesus is. Nobody there really gets who he is. He's Jesus. Son of carpenter, maybe a prophet. Not so sure just yet, but we know he can do things. Demon, he's like, I know who you are. Like, there's no question about it. You're not fooling me. This is a good way for you to think about a complicated biblical thing. In John, the Bible opens up the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 14, with a description of God becoming flesh. And it doesn't spell out the details for you, does it? Beginning was the Word. Word was made flesh. Word was manifest among men. In the text of Hebrews, we learn that God made a body for God, for Jesus. A body thou hast prepared for me is the structure of the text. So there's a body there. We also learn that people are more than bodies, right? What we see here is that the flesh side, us, can't see what makes Jesus, Jesus. Unless he reveals it. But the demons, who exist in a different context than we do, the flesh eye does not deceive them. That body that was made for them, or made for Jesus, is irrelevant. He knows exactly who he is. He knows exactly what's going on. And he's able to skip ahead. He's like, are you here to destroy me? Are you here to break me down? He's displaying his perception, the demon's perception. I use the male personifier because that's how it's used in the text. Of, I think that's what you're going to do to me. Does Jesus do that to any? Does Jesus destroy any of the otherworldly beings in the New Testament? Any demons that he just crushes and destroys? Think through for a minute. I'm unaware of any that he destroys. In fact, he is willing to listen to them and give them options. Because there's something reserved for them. There's a holdover point. So there's a point. You're going to be taken care of at a different time. And the text of Revelation reveals that. Teaching of Jesus reveals that later. So he interacts with them, they know who he is, and then we get to see and recognize all of this playing out in a deliberate way. Here is God, whom man cannot see as God, but the spiritual realm is already in turmoil because they know who he is. They know exactly whom Jesus is, and it's in a small little village where no one cared about, on the northern side of Jerusalem. And he's helping individuals. He's helping set people free from their possessions, from their health issues, and also a little bit of them beginning to see what it would be like to be free from the other oppressors around them, Roman, Jewish, or otherwise. Anything else that you guys see in the text here besides those two kind of interplays between these two sections, or questions you had, or thoughts? Yeah, I'm thinking through two points there. One is, I'm not super familiar with the New King James Version wording to recall it from memory, so I'm looking up at the text here to see how that gospel translates. So I found what I was looking for. So in the King James Version, it says, in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 4 and verse 33, and in the synagogue there was a man who had a spirit of an unclean devil. In the New King James Version, it uses demon. which is similar in the New American Standard, the ESV, and such. And a point that I want to make is that I know that in general, we use those words differently than they did when they originally translated the King James. We use the devil exclusively to refer to Satan as a construct. They used it more generically to not only include the devil, but also his demons. We've now separated two different words in English for that. And so in here in Luke, it's most likely that what's going on is not about the devil at all. That's a language use thing. Does that make sense? Is that clear for everybody? The change in wording there on that part. It doesn't mean the devil's not involved in this. It means most certainly he is, but it's not the devil possessing the man. It is, as it's rendered in most of our more recent translations, a servant, a minion, a follower. We refer to that as demon. Some translations we use unclean spirit. There's always a little bit of ambiguity also with these possessions, because unlike some of the servants of God who are given to us with names, none of the servants of the devil are given names. We don't know them independent of the others. Some of the angels we know by name. Their names are specified for us, and so we know them as independent creatures. For the most part, though, angels are part of a mass of beings we don't understand, which is the same in some levels for demons. A mass of beings that, at least I say, I don't understand. I think I understand a little bit more about angels than I do about demons, because God tells us a little bit more about angels and their role, that they're servants in that regard. But the difference is probably pretty minuscule. All right. That then sets us to the other half of things that Joe was talking about, which is what's going on in this conflict. Like even today, we could argue, we can identify that there seems no evidence of possession today. But as far as I can tell, that's something that went out of history, went out of the biblical construct at the same point that the spiritual gifts that were being granted through the apostles diminished as well. They continued after the crucifixion, but not long after. And so at some point, that was no longer a thing. And yet, does the Bible still talk to us, and do we still feel like we are in conflict with the unseen realm, with devils and demons? Is that something that we still feel like is a thing that we should be concerned about? Yeah. It's a real thing. Like, the unseen realm is totally a real thing. It's something that the Bible describes to us both in the Old Testament and the New Testament as an ongoing conflict that has resolution, but we haven't reached it fully yet. Jesus is discussed as that principal closure point in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 as being the last battle will be this final defeat. And it's the opening stanzas of the text of Genesis, as this conflict begins there and closes in the crucifixion. It closes in Revelation, and so you see all of that. So then what about me and you? Well, if we could say there seems little evidence to no evidence of possession today, like I got nothing I can say definitively that it happens. And since you can't really prove a negative in that sense on a logical level, that's as far as I can go from an emotional standpoint and from a conversational standpoint. But I do know that we're influenced by the world. And the Bible says very plainly that the world is one of the tools that the devil has. And then I also recognize that I'm my enemy. The text of James, in the process of the discussion of my rebellion and your rebellion and our rebellion, what are some of the steps that James talks about? He says about enticement regarding sin. He talks about, oh, look, this is how it goes. This is how it gives birth. You guys remember that text? Starts at some point, I acknowledge there's a thing that I want to do. You can break it down into a sense of that regard. Well, that looks like something I'd want to do. And the I gives birth internally to the decision. I'm going to do that. And the decision goes to the action. I did that. I gave birth to rebellion inside of me at that point. Is it only big things that that text is talking about? It's only about the public sins that are easy to describe and define.
It's in our everyday life. It's a struggle between our temptations of every single day.
Yep. You know, the clear, easy ones are defined with absolute clarity in the Bible. I will suggest to you there's a temptation that exists in that to then dismiss anything that's not those big, clear, specific words. If it's murder, don't do that. But if you murder somebody in your heart, does the Bible condemn that? By the way, it actually condemns it in a specific word in the works of the flesh. Like it's the lead up to it. Jesus deals with this in a very painful way. Adultery. Is adultery wrong? It's sin. What does Jesus say about adultery that makes it deeper than just a physical endeavor? You can look at a person in a manner that is equivalent on the moral level, not the legal level, the moral level of adultery. And he says, that's wrong. What we're seeing here in the sense of conflict and recognizing this two different views of Jesus in the gospel here is an opportunity for us to understand Joe's question, which is a common one and one that we all have to kind of grapple with. How am I waging this war so that I don't end up making these choices? And part of the thing that makes us successful is recognizing that the excuse that is internalized culturally of the devil made me do it is never a thing. In the context where possession takes place, does God in the flesh ever condemn the person possessed for their behavior? No, he doesn't save everybody, just like he told his hometown. But those he comes into contact with, he separates them, makes sure that the physical person, the spiritual person is cared for after they've been cleansed. And then he appropriately deals with the spiritual being from the unseen realm that was inhabiting them by whatever means that that takes place. That helps us understand that the concept of the devil making someone do something, at least in the sense of the clearest biblical opportunities for that to take place, isn't a thing. The devil doesn't make you do it. James clarifies, devil didn't make you do it. You chose it. That's a harder pill to swallow, right? In life, we make excuses like that. Well, I was only speeding because the guy behind me wouldn't skip. He just kept pushing me. Like I wanted to go 55, officer. But this is Atlanta, and he was going 85, and I thought I was going to die. Do you feel that way in the loop? I know I do. that's a normal feeling, right? It's totally fine to get into the inside lane and drive 55 or 65 or 75 or whatever the speed limit is. But very often we justify our behavior because something is pushing on us. When the thing that's pushing on us is actually us. Because in the end, that's what's going on. We're making these choices. So whether it be gossip, slander, evil surmising, mean speech, foul language, looking at inappropriate pictures, looking at pornography, you name the list, greed, avarice, gluttony, all the biblical bad words. Remember at the end of most of those lists, they include a phrase, I think the King James and the New American Standard use a phrasing that's similar to, and the such like. More simply, stuff like that. So if it's similar, then it's something you should worry about too. And worry about in a very simple sense. Hey, behave and live in a way which limits the opportunity for you to be enticed in that way. And when you're enticed, figure out, kind of like what Paul was suggesting to the letter, in his letter to the church of Corinth, when that avenue of escape is, when to cut it out. Jesus said things as simple as, maybe it's better to cut your eye out if that meant you could go to heaven, if your eye was causing you to sin.
I guess another way of phrasing or me understanding what you're saying, the clarity that you brought to me, is when we train our conscience as to what is acceptable and what is not.
Yeah, well, there's a building process there.
Exactly.
We learn on the basis of whom we are around. If you see the family of God you're around constantly biting and devouring one another, that's a biblical phrase, right? What do you think you're going to do if you live in that world?
Same thing.
And if someone fights against it, what happens to them? They run the risk of getting chewed up, right? Yeah. But they're right. They should fight against it. That's part of the hard balance of being part of the family of God too, because our examples and mentors aren't perfect. Jesus is, and we work through those disparities through time. That's it for our class this morning in the Gospel of Luke. We'll continue next Sunday. At this time, though, I want to thank everyone for their participation in class, and we can begin to get ready for the remainder of our time together this morning. Thanks, everybody.